More protests after the state attorney decides not to charge a police officer in the shooting of Vernell Bing Jr. Melissa Nelson also announcing the creation of a new juvenile justice board. And the hurricane may be gone, but its effects linger. We'll talk about it. And the rest of the stories making headlines this week just ahead. Good Friday morning. Aren't you glad it's Friday? Gosh, I know I am. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. And you can also get our podcast every day on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now and let us know how you're doing out there. People still dealing with a lot of after impacts from the storm. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, author Larry Baker. Plus, we'll hear about the upcoming Living Well Symposium with Gabriel House of Care. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time to talk about a busy news week as we welcome Tessa Duvall of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And our own regular contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Thanks for being here, guys. So much to discuss this week. Everything from the continuing after effects of Hurricane Irma to a new approach for juvenile justice in the city and more. But our top story this Friday, there were new protests this week in front of the Duval County Courthouse. This after State Attorney Melissa Nelson announced she will not seek charges against JSO officer Tyler Landerville in the shooting death of Vernell Bing Jr. In an unusual and striking move, Nelson released a 36-page report looking at all the evidence surrounding this controversial police-involved shooting, and explained why she didn't believe Landerville violated Florida law when he shot and killed Bing in a highly charged incident at 9th and Liberty in Springfield last year. There were protests again this week in the wake of the decision. We want your calls. Give us a call now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. Fred Matthews, let's begin with you. Right after Bing was killed, hundreds marched in protest. We saw several dozen come out again this week now that the state attorney has announced she does not believe the officer's actions violated the law. And of course, we're going to discuss the details of this incident, but for those who are unhappy with the decision, it's the latest to them in a long line of young African-American men being shot and killed by police and not facing charges. Those who support the officer say that the circumstances prove he acted lawfully. People see these incidents through their own narrative. Let's talk about what we know about the shooting and your thoughts about the protests as well.
Well, I wrote an article on this just after the incident occurred and walked through the neighborhood and talked with some of the neighbor residents there. It's a typical lower-income neighborhood where these things happen all the time. And what happens all the time equally is that the neighbors and everyone around it expects the same outcome, and that's basically what has happened here, despite the fact that we've had a new state attorney elected. And again, it just simply comes down to what the officer says happened versus what the victim says happened, and the victim cannot speak, and there's nobody else except for witnesses who would normally, if this were to go to trial, get a chance to speak. Well, it's not going to trial. And for, again, it just comes out the same way. a young man is dead. And the question is, I know that the majority of voters in Duval County are pretty much backing the officer because, if he tells you to stop, you should stop, should be the thing. But the question is, did the crime require a death sentence?
And Bing, let's be clear. Here's what we know about the case. Officers were chasing the 22-year-old Bing. He was driving a stolen car, a red Camaro, and they chased him through the Moncrief and Springfield areas at high speed. He then went from Liberty Street onto 9th Street and accelerated, according to police, toward the officer's cruiser, crashing head-on in the 300 block of East 9th Street. There, the accounts diverged. Tessa Duvall, according to the officer, he believed Bing was going to cause him harm. And that is why he shot Bing as Bing got out of his wrecked vehicle. Witnesses who were standing around on the street say they saw Bing limp away from the crash looking dazed. Landerville fired 5 times. Bing was hit once in the side of the head, killing him.
Yes. So what's really interesting about what Melissa Nelson did by releasing this massive trove of documents, because it's more than just a report. There were video recreations that used dashboard cam, home security footage, audio. I mean, just maps. You watch these things and you feel like you're kind of in this pursuit. Part of what they used in this is data from the cars that track, you know, the speed at which they were traveling at certain seconds, how much of the accelerator was pressed down. So we do know that the Camaro was traveling upwards of 60 miles an hour shortly before it hit the police officer's vehicle. And, you know, this is also where the state attorney's office spent a lot of time. You can tell on the videos that it put together. There's an entire video just put out there intended to discredit probably one of the most prominent witnesses after the event, and says, well, look, he couldn't have seen this thing. You know, he was a block away, his view was obscured. So, I mean, it really, the state attorney put a lot of effort into showing that, you know, some of these witnesses making some of the statements that really kind of got a lot of traction after the media may not have been accurate based on what they could put together after the fact.
And of course, there was no video of the actual altercation. Tim Gibbons, if this officer had been wearing a body camera, there would have been. And we're now JSO, like other departments, in part due to extreme pressure and controversy about these shootings over many years all over the country and here locally, officers are now going to be wearing body cameras.
I think that it's kind of the idea, even with the recreations that they did, is the more information that you can have, the more people feel comfortable with the decision. You know, I wasn't there. I don't know what happened. I don't feel comfortable even saying that this was a correct decision or not. But the idea that it looks like the state attorney is trying to give people a higher comfort level with the decision, I think, as Fred alluded to, there is a general belief that if a police officer is involved in an altercation, I mean, not just a belief, they very much do get the benefit of the doubt. In some ways, that it puts the state attorney in an awkward position.
It's rare for officers to be prosecuted.
Very much so.
Even rarer for them to be convicted. That's not to say it never happens, but it's unusual.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there is a difference between simply dropping the charges or not bringing charges, as has been done in other areas, and at least making an effort to come out with a report that shows this is what that decision was based on.
Fred, Melissa Nelson certainly being far more transparent than her predecessor, Angela Corey, in releasing all of this information and getting plaudits for that. But it's certainly at the same time not satisfying critics who feel that the circumstances warranted further review.
Well, I mean, the credit for her being more transparent is interesting, but the fact of the matter is, as most people realize, and as many citizens realize now, the system is set up to give the officer the benefit of the doubt. The first thing is, it took how many months for the police to release whatever information they had to the state attorney, or release any of that publicly so that anybody could have any information about what took place? That's normally, what, 18 months now, minimum. We've gone through an election, so now it falls in Melissa Nelson's lap to take a look at this under her new guidelines. That has to take place. So now we're into almost 2 years of this thing. You couple that with nothing justifies anything else, but again, you still come down to the same thing. Does the crime elicit a death sentence? We had a gentleman that was shot over at Vic's Sandwich Shop on Edgewood Avenue a few weeks ago. And everybody, he was drunk or disorderly or something. He showed up with a knife. He was still in the car, and it looked like he had a gun. So he got shot and killed. Now, did that warrant a death penalty? What was his crime? And that's what comes back to this. And that's what folks look at. And for many in the black community, where the majority of these shootings have taken place, and we're going back 30 years, all the way to Michael Alexander at Boulevard and what was then 20th Street Expressway, who was shot and killed by Officer S.K. Johns. Again, what was the crime? Speeding? Riding down the road too fast? You didn't stop? And the guy's dead. And there was never anything else said about it. And that's the history of what we're dealing with here, is that we have the deck stacked in the officer's favor. The majority of voters are fine with that as long as it doesn't affect them. And there's nothing, and then it comes down to a decision made by one person in an office who can make that without a jury or a trial. And until we're willing to accept to address that, we're going to continue to have these stories over and over again, and people upset and lack of trust in the justice system.
And as Fred says, I mean, I think there is that sense that most people are okay with this. You read any of the discussion happening around this, it's basically, well, you shouldn't have stolen a car. With that kind of being, and that's an argument that if you're a strong law and order sort of person, you're saying, well, broke the law, and anything that happens after that basically is a justified outcome. Yeah, I think the argument that Fred is making is, well, is it?
There is a civil lawsuit proceeding in this. Where does that stand, Tessa?
Well, there are several things that still can come from this. So we know there aren't criminal charges. That's the decision that Melissa Nelson made. Now JSO begins its review with its own independent board. And then also there is the civil suit that comes next. So this is not, while the criminal charges portion of this is not complete, there is still these other avenues. And under the previous presidential administration, the FBI did announce that there was an intent to look at this for civil rights violations. You know, some things have changed since then. I don't know if that is still something that's proceeding, but there are still other steps.
Okay. And lots of calls on this as we talk about the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Give us a call. We'll talk about hurricane stuff in a moment. We want to hear how everybody's getting along out there. But right now, give us a call about this, our top story of the week, 549-2937. John is in Ortega. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in. I was worked under Angela Corey and Harry Shorstein as a prosecutor, and
oh, okay.
I'm just not sure we're not looking at the facts here. I can respect Fred's point of view and the other gentleman on the line, but the fact is that this guy rammed into an officer head on after being in a high speed chase. He was known to have been in a shootout with another gentleman, I think, several days prior, according to the report. So, you know, to say that the state attorney's office didn't just, you know, release everything and make a decision in a week is, I think it's just unreasonable. And I think to me it shows, having worked in that office, I know the detail and the depth of the investigation that they go into. And it is not the consensus that, well, this guy stole a car and therefore he should have been shot and killed by police. That's not what happened. The facts are that this guy rammed his vehicle into the officer. And that is what, you know, things transpired from there. So I just think in a lot of these cases, because of other factors that are at play, I think people ignore facts and things that happen and that are documented in this report. And I think it's a good step forward that her office is now releasing these things ahead of time. And I have to take my comments off here.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, John.
Well, I mean, the discussion still goes to, well, okay, the officer's car was rammed. Did Mr. Bing get out of the car, and did he walk to the officer? Did he have a weapon? And if he had a weapon, where was it? And again, was he advancing? When he got out of the car, was he advancing toward the officer, or was he walking away? And whose eyewitness is going to tell that? You know, that's the story. It's still the same thing. I mean, you know, without a trial that's open and everybody can see it and you have witnesses on the stand, you still come down to what one person says happened and the victim has no chance to speak. In this case, the perpetrator, if you want to call him that, has no chance to speak. Did Mr. Bing have a weapon or not? Was he running away after he rammed the car? I mean, the officer didn't know at the time that there was a shooting that took place 2 days ago.
He did.
Okay.
He did.
Okay.
But I think that the reason that Ms. I don't want to speak for her, but if I may, officers in Florida just have to say that they feared for their life.
That's all.
But I would argue that hitting somebody with your car at upwards of 60 miles per hour, that could be a deadly car crash. Head on. You know, I'm not sure that, you know, this case is, I understand so deeply why people wanted a different outcome. I'm just not sure that this case had the facts to make that happen.
This is a complicated case.
Yes.
But as Fred pointed out, the long history of mistrust and sorrow and anger among African Americans, just going back so many years with so many other cases, is layered into this discussion.
That's why we have, you know, the various cases where you people can be held up who literally aren't doing anything wrong. They're sitting in a park playing with a toy gun, sort of thing.
Like 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland was shot and killed.
Yeah. And I think people seize on those because it can show the very tip of the issue, the situation, the problem. When you have a situation like this where it becomes messier, it's not somebody who is just sitting in a car, not doing anything, getting shot, where that you can easily have a, you know, nobody thinks people should just be sitting in cars getting shot. This does become a murkier situation.
Okay, Tracy in Mandarin. Go ahead, Tracy.
Yes, I am a brown person, so I think in this particular case, it wasn't racial. This 22-year is not a kid. He stole a car. He stole a car. That's a crime. He was speeding is a crime. He banged into a policeman. He would have killed him. And, you know, policemen, their life is at danger. I think people have to think this way. I think policeman was right. Bye.
Okay. Clue in Clay County. Go ahead, Clue.
Hey, good morning. I have a couple things. Number one, he shouldn't have stole a car. Number two, he shouldn't have ran from the police. And number three, for whatever he's done in the past, the police officer probably knew about it. But from what I'm hearing is that I guess the police officer thought that his life was in danger when he ran the car 60 miles an hour and his life would be in danger. But when I got out of the car, was his life in danger then? Did he pull a gun on that police officer? Or did he shoot at that police officer? And what made that police officer justified to shoot him? The next thing is that has anybody done a study in the state of Florida that realizes how many times the state attorney does not prosecute a police officer for shooting somebody in the state of Florida? And I guarantee if you look at that, it's probably like below 1%.
And you're talking police officers, prosecuting police.
I'm talking about police involved shootings when a police officer shoots another person.
Okay, yeah.
Has anybody ever done a study where how many times a state attorney has not prosecuted a police officer in the state of Florida?
Thanks, Clue. I don't have the number on that, but it's unusual, certainly. And it's only been in recent years with the advent of cell phones with video capability and citizens whipping out their smartphones, Fred, and recording what they're seeing and sharing that video widely on social media so that civilians have a counter narrative to whatever the official law enforcement line is on what happened in these controversial incidents. It's these viral videos that have really forced this more broadly into the public conversation. It's what sparked all this discussion and moved toward body cameras by police. Because now people can see with their own eyes. For example, in South Carolina, an officer was convicted recently, highly unusual, but he was convicted because video clearly showed that as the man was running away, the officer shot the guy in the back. And everybody saw the video that a citizen captured of that. And so those incidents that's really been a sea change, I think.
And it's been a sea change because they were allowed to go to trial. Once the state attorney decides that it's not going to take the case is unwinnable, which is what I presume is Attorney Nelson's decision here, is the case was unwinnable for her in trial, so she decided not to prosecute it. And that is the other part of this issue. It's not so much a question of whether or not the officer was justified or not, but the fact of the matter is that he does not have to stand trial because one person decided that the case was unwinnable, so we're not going to take it to trial. And you just have to, the other side has to live with that.
According to research from Bowling Green State University, there's been about 77 officers who have actually been charged with murder or manslaughter since 2005. That number has been increasing in the past couple of years. There have been more nationally, not just in Florida, but nationally, there have been more officers actually brought to trial. But when we say more, we're talking about it going up from 10 to 12.
Yeah. And let's also point out that our current sheriff, Mike Williams, when he's appeared on this program, has embraced body cameras in terms of not only holding his own officers accountable, but also providing video that can be objectively viewed by not only the police, but citizens
as well. I think this goes back to Nelson's report of that idea of, you know, as Tessa said earlier, if you can actually show more information, you can you give people a different comfort level. If they had video of this, people could go, yeah, well, okay, you know, now we see that he has a gun and it was a justified shooting, or we can see that he was stumbling away dazed and it's not. So
I mean, look, there's still a lot more police shootings that they're going to have to address. So if this protocol stays in place, then maybe that's when we start to see, you know, shootings that are less clear cut or kind of see just how complicated some of these are.
Lots of people waiting on hold, but we do want to make note of another important development this week when it comes to the state attorney's office. The number to join us is 549-2937. Also this week, State Attorney Nelson announced the creation of a new Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee that will work to improve juvenile diversion programs and outcomes for kids in the juvenile justice system. Again, this is a marked departure from former state attorney Angela Corey's practices. She was extremely tough on juveniles, and you could argue it played a part in her defeat at Nelson's hands. Fred Matthews, Nelson is putting together this new panel. Buddy Schultz, an attorney with Holland and Knight, is going to lead this committee. He was involved, of course, in the negotiations that involved 12-year-old Christian Fernandez, who was eventually sent away for life in the death of his 2-year-old brother. Eventually, some lawyers got him moved into juvenile hall instead. What about this push toward a more holistic and a more science-based way of treating juveniles who, you know, studies show their brain development is still in process, and most countries acknowledge that they should not be charged as adults, that it's considered cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, I think it's a good step forward. It's certainly, again, one of the points that folks were looking forward to her getting elected, and she's following through on that campaign promise. Having a firm, an attorney from a firm like Holland and Knight to lead it, they have a long history of social justice issues within that law firm. And I think it's a good step forward. It will certainly allow the cases that come there, I guess the individual cases, be looked at. But deeper than that, and as many of the articles indicate, there are several other activities taking place with this. Jack's Journey, of course, has been long involved in this sort of thing. But deeper than this, we have to still get to the root of the issue, because this will still be after the fact. The crime has already been committed. The kid is up before the court, and you basically, in the end, you're looking for leniency or less leniency or being let off. We still have to get to the core of the issue, which is the neighborhoods and the parents and the significant others that breed these kids that end up in the juvenile justice system. That's the issue.
No doubt. No doubt that socioeconomics and all these other factors play a role in, you know, juvenile justice. You know, how many kids you end up in the juvenile justice system, end up within the system. You know, I mean, that's an indicator of child well-being in a lot of ways, because happy, healthy, well-adjusted children more often than not don't go out and commit crimes and mm-hmm. really serious crimes especially. But I spent yesterday calling a lot of folks who are going to be on this committee, and one of the reoccurring things, whether they said her name or not, is just, this is so different than anything Angela Corey would have done. Like, that is the most exciting thing about this for a lot of people, is because Angela Corey was very insistent that her way was the right way when it came to, you know, charging children as adults, or when it came to her diversion programs, which included, you know, debunked scared straight tactics. She was adamant that her things were the right way, and it didn't really matter what the research said, according to a lot of these people that I talked to. So these people are just mm-hmm. really excited that there is a prosecutor who is not only willing to come to the table, but to kind of convene this group and take a leadership role.
I think this goes far beyond symbolism, to be clear, but even if it was just symbolism, that's important. The idea of, again, it's showing that break between the previous person in the office. And if you do think that break was necessary, which many voters did, this is basically fulfilling a campaign promise of saying, yes, we're going in a different direction.
Right. In particular, fewer kids direct filed, you know, where they get tossed right into the system with adult charges or serious felony charges. more use of the civil citation process that's been recommended for a long time so that children who commit a misdemeanor aren't automatically shunted into what criminal justice reform advocates call the school-to-prison pipeline, mm-hmm. whereby if a kid is charged with something rather than getting a civil citation, once they're in the system, they tend to stay in the system, and outcomes can be pretty bad. So let's get your calls on this. It's 549-2937. Ray is in Riverside this morning. Hey, Ray, happy Friday.
Hey, good morning. Well, I just wanted to say that, like, you know, at least we have a state attorney now that is willing to do at least something positive to try to undo the damage of the previous one. So it is a positive step in that direction. But I just wanted to say that, you know, in the core of the situation is that these people are reelected on conviction rates. Conviction rates are everything to every state attorney, regardless of where you are or who they are. And right now they have, and it ties into the last topic, and it's like, it's why these kind of kids are getting, like, prosecuted, and it's why police don't get prosecuted, and it's that it comes down to conviction rates. If it's easy to convict someone, if they can open and shut, they're going to take it, regardless if it's the moral thing.
Oh, we lost him. But thank you, Ray. As you pointed out a minute ago, Fred, with the Vernell Bing case, prosecutors don't take cases that they don't think they can win.
That's really the bottom line. You're right. Conviction rates are a big deal, but you just don't take losers. Look, everybody should take a chance and go up to the second floor of the Duval County Courthouse, I think all the way to the end on 200, I think it's court 201. If you ever get a chance, go and sit for about 2 hours, starting at about 8 o'clock to 12, you'll get a good dose of the juvenile justice system and how it works, how the state attorney works with the public defender and the regional public defender, and how the judge plays a role in all of that. And it's like watching a three-ring circus, because everybody has their part, but the prosecutor has to get their orders from the state attorney as to how they're going to handle each juvenile case. It's worth your time to go sit down and watch it so you can see what's going on. You probably won't understand it, and you'll probably be angry at some of the things you see. But this is the impact that a state attorney can have on the system, is that you don't have 14-year-olds being prosecuted for life when they're simply not aware what they did at that point. They won't understand that, what happened at 35.
And it's all about brain development and research looking at a child's impulse control, behavior, development. This is science-based decision-making that we're seeing out of this prosecutor's office.
And there are people on this advisory committee who are going to make sure that she remembers that. I think it's something that's widely accepted, but there are people who won't let them forget.
I think the caller earlier is mostly right, that traditionally prosecutors have been judged basically just on conviction rates. But I think what the last election showed in this office in particular is there is a group of voters who are not simply looking at that. They basically want good convictions, so to speak. That mm-hmm. Convicting a 12-year-old as an adult, sure, you did something, but not what at least some amount of voters are looking for.
David is on the South Side. Hi, David. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, if an underage child, typically we see it with actors who have large financial stakes, they have to go before a judge and prove they're competent to gain their majority, to have their rights as an adult. When a child is made or brought forward to an adult court, do they have to go before, does a judge have to rule them competent, or is it just a decision? And it seems that the violence of the crime makes them the adult. And I would like to also mention that the police problem of the resistance when they're arresting is also driven by the courts and the judges' sentencing. I mean, the prisons, if everything is so terrible and they feel their life is over if they get rearrested, it's going to make the policeman's job terribly much harder, and the resistance and whatever goes on more so.
All right.
I would just like to ask about the whole chain of events, not just the one, because they affect the police job.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, David. And lots of callers. We so appreciate all of your calls on all of this news. But we're getting a little tight on time, so I want to move on and just check in with everybody still recovering from the floodwaters from Hurricane Irma. The portion of Florida's peninsula that's really been hit hard by this is our area, the St. Johns River, of course, flooding vast areas of this area. And according to state environmental officials, agricultural and industrial waste have been added to the list of bad stuff that's contaminating the St. Johns River. There's a lot of sewage, a lot of debris in there. It's not safe to go kayaking through little pools. It's not safe to go in the water, period. That's just one way we're still feeling the effects of this, Tim Gibbons.
It's like a toxic tea that kind of has poured around once everything was soaked into the ground, so you know, became soaked into the water. And it's a big issue. I mean, we tend to think that once the floodwaters recede that, you know, the river goes back to being, well, not clean exactly, but as clean as it was, but it doesn't. And
yeah, people have this idea, oh, it's a cleansing effect. It's actually just the opposite.
Well, I guess the streets are cleaner, but
yeah.
And then you still have the, you know, the Wells Fargo building still dealing with issues. The number of buildings that still have water in their basements, if you have basements in Florida, which is odd, but yeah.
Yeah, but we have a basement here at WJCT. It's highly unusual. We did get a little water in the basement. Nothing horrible, but yeah, Fred.
You guys are operating from the transmitter for a day or two, right?
Yes, yeah.
Literally.
Generator power, that's right.
But I mean, it's really strange to see the most iconic building that we have in the city for the longest time. For those of us who've been here a long time, we used to call it the Independent Building. They were out of power. Mm-hmm. People had to leave. And we see pictures of folks on the 11th, 13th, 14th floor having to walk down the stairs in the dark to get to the bottom floor to haul their equipment out. This is how big an impact this had upon this city. The flooding was something else. And still to this day, believe it or not, I don't think we have just a few people left without power, but we still do have some folks who are still trying to get there. And we're going to be remembering this one for another year. It's going to take much longer for folks to really get back on their feet after this. The question that we're going to be left with, however, is how are we going to keep ourselves from repeating this same process? Are we going to look at these lines that we have that string all over the place? Are we going to keep this going or what?
Are we looking at stronger resiliency efforts?
I'm going to say no.
It does not.
So the issue of underground utilities actually has come up much more vocally now than it has in the past. There is a, I wouldn't say yet a concerted push, but there's something approaching that. But it's a huge, gargantuan, highly expensive project that JEA has basically said they have no interest in doing. So, I mean, I'm sure that we can talk about it. I would look forward to a year from now being on this show when we talk about, you know, we should have underground utilities.
But it can't be any more gargantuan than the amount of money that we're going to spend, the amount of money they're spending trying to get that nuclear plant paid off in Georgia that they bought into.
And as we continue to ponder these weighty matters, we want to send you off into the weekend with at least a little bit of a smile. Here's our look at the strange, ridiculous, and just plain bizarre news from the state this week. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida, the post-Irma edition. Only in Florida do people feel so jubilant about having survived Hurricane Irma that they let their alcohol do their thinking for them. Yeah, this could apply to a lot of us, actually. 32-year-old Eric Blaze of Tamarack was feeling frisky Friday when he decided to climb into the driver's seat of a fire rescue truck and just drive it away.
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of men have this fantasy.
I've always wanted to do that.
Blaze could not figure out how to get the truck into gear, though, so he fled on foot and is now facing charges.
His name was Blaze.
Only in Florida do people steal generators used to power traffic lights after Hurricane Irma. 40-year-old Jason Hope of Davie is arrested. Police spotted him with his car hood up and hazard lights on, but he was not asking for help. Then they noticed the chain meant to secure a nearby generator had been cut and saw a pair of bolt cutters inside his silver Mazda.
Oh, man.
People want their AC.
I know it. And finally, only in Florida do strong storms reveal the presence of long-lost ships. Yes, it could take months to figure out the identity of a mysterious ghost ship beached after Hurricane Irma in Melbourne Beach. It's an unoccupied 45-foot sailboat named Cookie. No cost estimate yet available on how much they're going to have to pay to remove this vessel. Electronics have been stripped from the sailboat since it ran aground, and two mannequins removed. Their purpose on the boat remains a mystery.
Whoa. You can't end the show like that.
But I can because it's Florida. Whoa. See? Mannequins on a sailboat. Well, of course. Why not?
I hope they had fun.
Thank you, Tim Gibbons, Fred Matthews, and Tessa Duvall. Great work during the storm, and thanks for being here. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at TerrellHogan.com.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. I grew up in West Palm Beach, just down I-95 from Jacksonville, and it always amazed me how many different kinds of people that highway connects. Now I get to connect with people from all walks of life here on WJCT, debating tough topics with courage, clarity, and compassion. Join us for 1A, weekday mornings at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Ray from Car Talk. You know, for the last 30 years, you've had to put up with this. And we know it's been a struggle. Well, it's time for Car Talk to make room on this station for something new and hopefully a little more professional. You can still listen to us online, but here on the station, we hope you enjoy the next generation of great programs. And thanks.
Join us for the final episode of Car Talk, September 30th on 89.9 WJCT.
The very best of modern folk and acoustic alternative music tonight on String Theory. Listen to String Theory this evening at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in, find out.
Welcome back. Well, author Larry Baker might live in Iowa, but his fictional home is definitely Florida. Four of Baker's six novels are set right here in our area. And to mark the 20th anniversary of the publication of his first novel, The Flamingo Rising, Baker is returning to this area and doing several public events over the weekend. We've got a preview right now as author Larry Baker is on the line. Hey, Larry. Do we have Larry? Author Larry Baker, are you there? Okay, well, they're going to try to connect Larry. We're going to talk about the national tour for his sixth novel. It's called From a Distance. And he'll be opening this up at the Florida Heritage Book Festival in St. Augustine. Now, Flamingo Rising was a finalist for the Barnes & Noble Great New Voices Award in 1997, and it actually became a CBS television movie in 2001, adapted by Hallmark and filmed in St. Augustine. It's even taught in public and parochial high schools all over the country, but how about this? It's also included in the American Library Association's list of banned books. So when Baker comes to town, he's going to kick off Banned Books Week in Jacksonville on Sunday, September 24th, at the downtown Jacksonville Public Library, where he's going to read a chapter from his book, Flamingo Rising, and then talk about censorship and free speech issues. So this will be really interesting to hear from him on this. He is also going to be appearing at St. John's Technical High School on September 22nd. On the 23rd, that's today, actually. On the 23rd, he'll be at the Florida Heritage Book Festival at Flagler College. He'll also be at the Corazon Theater in St. Augustine on the 23rd. And he, again, is appearing on the 24th at the downtown Jacksonville Public Library at 2 o'clock. So four different appearances to see long-time beloved Florida author Larry Baker. Do we have him? Oh, we certainly don't have him. I'm so sorry to hear that. We're going to try to reconnect him. That's a shame. But again, Larry Baker coming to town this weekend to talk about his new novel, From a Distance. And he will be kicking off Banned Books Week at the Jacksonville Public Library as well. We're going to try to connect him and take a quick break.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Sit back, relax, and travel back in time with 89.9 on Sunday nights beginning at 7 with Radio Theater.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Doo-wop Revival.
Good evening, I'm Glenn Fisher, the king of the doo-woppers.
Relax Radio. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Online at WJCT.org. Looking forward to looking back.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele, hoping you'll join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater. Our guests include Jim James, Amy Mann, and the hilarious comedy of Hurry Kondabolu. Plus, the Royal Academy of Radio Actors and Ms. Sarah Watkins will be in the house. We'll have our musician's birthday salute, the Powdermilk Instant Song Request, and I'll have a brand new song for you, all this and more this weekend.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a chance to learn about living well, exploring everything from mindfulness to acupuncture, cognitive therapy, and a lot more. The Gabriel House of Care Living Well Symposium is coming up next week with experts on hand from Mayo Clinic, Brooks Rehabilitation, and UF Health. We've got a preview from Executive Director Valerie Callahan, and we could all stand to be living well. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. And thanks for being with us. This sounds really interesting.
Mm-hmm. We've been really focused on alternative and complementary medicine throughout the last 6 years of the house being open. We've brought it into Gabriel House for our transplant and cancer patients and caregivers. And it's been really successful. So it was a great time, we thought, with all the stress of the hurricane to begin to help people understand.
Sure.
How
people need this.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, we need it.
Yeah, I bet. Now, Gabriel House of Care is right adjacent to Mayo Clinic. And when people come to Mayo for treatment from all over the world, often they stay at Gabriel.
Right. Organ transplant and cancer patients. Those are the two disciplines that stay with us. And we're on the Mayo campus.
You're right on the campus. Mm-hmm. And so these are patients that are exploring these types of therapies.
Not necessarily.
Not always, yeah. But sometimes.
There are other medical centers as well that utilize our lodging facility, UF Proton Baptist. The patients come for medical treatment, so they really aren't aware of the stress and the trauma that they're under until we get them. When you're in a community environment, in a home environment, everybody begins to act a certain way. Their real stress comes out, and we had to figure out ways to help them with their quality of life.
So when people come out to this, and by the way, this is Wednesday, September 27th, what will they get to learn?
So we focused on three different areas. Actually, this is kind of interesting because the young woman that was going to work with speak on arts and healing, creative arts, a tree fell on her house during the hurricane.
Oh.
So, but how interesting is that, right? At a time when there's so much stress.
Yeah.
So we're focusing on mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is a therapy that was actually created by Jon Kabat-Zinn at University of Massachusetts Medical Center, used across the country in medical centers now to help patients deal with stress and coping. in all different facets, but especially in the medical, with medical treatment and procedures. So Dr. Callahan's going to be speaking on that. He's a psychotherapist in private practice in Jacksonville. Dr. Ron Reimer is a neurosurgeon from Mayo, a great guy, and he does acupuncture for autonomic dysfunction with transplant patients, cancer patients post-treatment with tremendous success. He's fascinating, and I really wanted to introduce him more to the community. We also incorporated music therapy, which is very not known. I don't think any of us even understand it. Daniel Porter and Susan Moore from Brooks. Danielle actually started the music therapy program at Brooks Rehab, and so impressed with these young women. They don't just use the calming effects of music, which all of us think. They use the rhythm, the pitch, for stroke victims and brain injury patients.
So there are all sorts of new ways people that are healing can can heal. And and these are science-based therapies, too, by the way. This isn't people listening might go, oh, I don't believe that any of that will work. There's science behind this.
This is all medical evidence-based.
So, yeah, evidence-based healing therapies. This is so important to so many people. So how can people be part of the Gabriel House of Care Living Well Symposium?
This is a lunch-in symposium Wednesday, the 27th, at Gabriel House on the West Campus of Mayo. It's from 11:30 to 1:30. You can register on our website, gabrielhouseofcare.org, or you can go on our Facebook page.
Valerie Callahan, thanks for giving us this preview. I could use some healing after the last week myself. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we do have author Larry Baker back on the line now. He's making a bunch of appearances in town this weekend to talk about his first novel, The Flamingo Rising, which is actually on a banned books list, and also his new book. Larry Baker, are you there?
I am here having a heart attack. Getting on, you know, I'm listening to you introduce me, say nice things about me, and all of a sudden you disappear, and I can't get back, and I'm talking to strangers at the station.
You mean Kevin Mershart? Great, yeah, he's very strange, I know.
Yeah, strange. And I had this great idea for a new book called Mannequins in the Radio Studio, and then, you know.
Okay, we're very tight on time, my friend.
Yes,
and so tell me very quickly what you're going to be doing.
Yes, ma'am. All right. Tomorrow morning at the Florida Heritage Book Festival at Flagler College, I'll be introducing my new novel, From a Distance, at 9 o'clock. And then at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at the Horizon Theater down in San Augustine, they're showing the Hallmark movie version of my first novel. And then I'm going to talk about film adaptation after that. But the big deal is Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock, downtown Jacksonville Public Library. The book that got me on the banned books list, I am going to read the chapter that got me banned. I'm going to perform with the help of Catherine Currier down there the scene that is so outrageous that I'm on the banned book list. And that's, you know, I want to get down there and entertain people.
But this was a Hallmark movie, so it sounds pretty family friendly.
Well, you know what the thing is? The Hallmark people specifically told me they weren't going to put in the movie the chapter that I'm going to read Sunday afternoon.
Oh, I see. So you're kicking off Banned Books Week Sunday at the public library. This is Sunday afternoon. Now, you live in Iowa, Larry, but your books are all set here in Northeast Florida. Why is that?
Well, I used to live in St. Augustine for years. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, Iowa is not the most interesting state in the world. We don't have a lot of things. I mean, we have drought. Basically, we have drought, pigs and corn, and you just don't get a lot of fiction
and
out of that.
What about Field of Dreams? There's that. You got that,
Field
at least.
Field of Dreams, but they threw in baseball.
Yeah.
And, you know, that idea was stolen. I can't use that anymore. and I'm trying to think of any other notable Iowa book that doesn't involve agriculture. So
you've just got to keep writing about Florida.
It's got great people, great circumstances. It's got mannequins on a boat. It's got the food for fiction.
It does. There's no shortage of good stories here. That is a fact. Now, again,
I'm putting you in a book.
You're putting me in a book? I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, my next book. But I'm going to have a Melissa Ross character.
I love it. I can't wait to read it. You need to go out and meet Larry Baker meantime at the Florida Heritage Book Festival this weekend. That's Saturday. And then Corazon Theater in St. Augustine, Saturday afternoon, they're going to screen the movie version of one of his books. And then Sunday at the Jacksonville Public Library, come on out Sunday afternoon as Larry talks about censorship and free speech issues and kicks off Banned Books Week at the library. I hope you enjoy your visit here.
I'm doing fine so far. And, you know, if you can make it, Melissa, come down and we'll dedicate the chapter to you.
Oh, that's very nice. I may just do that. Thank you so much for, and I'm glad we could get you on the air. From now on, we're just not going to, I think we're going to go landlines only. This just, technology being what it is. Larry Baker, thank you for being with us.
No, thank you a lot, Melissa.
Okay, and a quick programming note, finally this hour. TEDx is a platform for our local citizenry that gives ideas and dreams a voice. We want you to make sure and watch TEDx Jacksonville tonight at 9 p.m. on WJCT Public Television, a special television hour looking at the voices of TEDx Jacksonville. That's tonight at 9 here on WJCT. All right, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We always value your feedback. Emails always go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Get your questions and comments coming. And never miss a show. Our podcast is up every day on iTunes and the WJCT app. And another reminder, if you ever miss a show in the morning, you can always listen to the rebroadcast every night at 8 on 89.9. 1A is up next with a look at the Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. See you then, and have a great weekend, First Coast.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.